I never forget the first moment when I walked in Curious Cinema. I was hooked from there on.
Hello, welcome to the Scan On Podcast, taking a look at the week in film, Irish International. I'm your host, Darren, and joining me are...
Ronan, hello.
Luke.
Hi. And Jay.
And we'll talk about the week in film news, the top 10, and the new releases this week. But let's jump in with our regular feature, which is what we watched this week. Because I think this week we had a far-flung foreign correspondent. Ronan, you went international.
You betcha. I went specially out of my way just for this podcast.
I know, it's exclusive.
From a foreign land.
Yeah.
No, I attended, as I have done for the last... what is it? This is my fifth edition at the Transylvania International Film Festival in Cluj-Napoca, Romania. Which is a fantastic festival. It is, this year was in its 17th edition, which maths and film nerds among you will know was effectively means that it was there 2 years before the Romanian New Wave kind of kicked in.
Yeah.
And it's been a big part in pushing the Romanian film agenda across Europe and giving exposure to the filmmakers who've managed to break out in Cannes, Berlin. And I think, crucially, a lot of those, they screen at Transylvania now, but it's not their first screening because they've turned up the big three festivals. It was a really good week. It always is. They do a competition strand that has usually about a dozen features specifically for first and second time directors, which is a really interesting approach to things, I think, to kind of get new names out there. But usually I duck out of that completely and just dive into the Romanian films, the Romanian Days sidebar, which this year threw up a couple of riches. The shorts competition had some really, really good stuff in there. There's one film called A Christmas Gift that I really, really enjoyed filming the festival for me, about a dad who really comically realizes his son has basically put his own anti-communist rhetoric into a letter that may or may not be seen by the authorities. And he's scrambling to figure out, what do I do about this? Pouring detergent in post boxes. It is hilarious. And I love, at this festival, seeing that with home crowd, who will pick up even more of the gags, obviously, than I would, having lived through a lot of this.
Is this the one that won?
It won, yeah, it won the short film prize. It's fantastically funny, and it kind of calls back to the likes of 1208 East of Bucharest, the feature from Corneliu Borumboiu that it won, I think, the Camera d'Or in Cannes back in 2006 or so. And it kind of continues that strand of, for me anyway, there's been like an aesthetic of Romanian cinema. International correspondents tend to point out, you know, stuff like, say, 4 months, 3 weeks, 2 days, or The Death of Mr. Lazarescu. Really dark, serious, often very long dramas with extended takes, and, you know, not a lot of camera movement, perhaps. And for me, the most interesting Romanian films of the last decade plus at this stage, have been the comedies that grapple with the communist past through humour. And this, I think, definitely continues that trend. I absolutely loved it. There were a lot of other things to recommend there. Interestingly, there was a lot of Romanian queer cinema, which is a new thing. It's one of the six EU countries that has no recognition for same-sex partnerships. Okay. And public opinion towards LGBT, the LGBT population, it remains sort of not great there. In Cluj-Napoca, which is a very liberal, student-heavy city, that's not quite the case. And the festival has done great at pushing that agenda. Approximately 2 to 3 of the dozen competition titles have featured LGBT themes across the couple of years I've been attending. But this year there were 4 to 5 Romanian titles that looked at these issues, which is new and really, really fascinating. Several conversations with a very tall girl. It's hard to get in one go. It's one of the features, lesbian romance feature, 70 minutes long, told a lot through Skype.
Through the windows or something.
It's really fascinating, really well done. It's a debut feature, and you can tell at times, but really fascinating to see these things. And just one other thing I will single out, I mostly focus on the Romanian stuff, like I say, but the best new feature I saw there was a Ukrainian film called When the Trees Fall, which I'm not sure what festival debuted at, but it possibly debuted at Berlin. It is absolutely terrific. Really gritty, dark, distressing, but also sort of magic realist. There are lots of visual and narrative flights of fancy in it. It's the story of a woman with pretty limited prospects who falls in love with a local low-rung crime man.
Criminal.
The local crime man.
The crime man. like the milkman, but yeah. The crime.
I knew
you need some crime delivered to your door.
Criminal is the word I was looking for. It's really, really terrific. A debut feature by a female Ukrainian director, and it's, I think, possibly the best new feature I've seen this year. Just visually stunning, and it opens with this 10-minute overture that I won't really go into what happens, because a lot of it was me looking at the screen going, what is this? Oh my god. Really blows you away. Really, really impressed with it. That was my week in Romania.
Alright. Taking us possibly closer to home, Luke?
Yeah, so I didn't get to see too much this week, but on Thursday last, I was over at the IFI for their screening of What's Up Doc, Peter Bogdanovich's kind of love letter to the screwball comedies of the 30s with Barbara Streisand and Ryan O'Neill. And it was introduced by Grainne Humphreys from the Dublin International Film Festival, and she kind of, as she was introducing it, she mentioned how she never quites to get as many comedies on the programme at DIFF as she would like. If she got more films like this, it would be fantastic for the festival. It's hysterically funny. Just a really fantastic the kind of comedy film that they don't make anymore. You know, the...
Oh, it's nostalgic at the time, even.
Yeah, yeah, very much so. The kind of pie in the face, man on a ladder kind of style of comedy that works so well. It's just so simple and so effective. There's this big thing in kind of mainstream American comedy films right now with the kind of the improv that's kind of, you know, leaning on from kind of the Judd Apatow. He produces so many of them, directs some of them, of the big mainstream ones, to do the kind of very loose
dialogue driven
Yeah. And some of them are good, some of them are not very good at all, but it's
most
very interesting to me because when people talk to actors that are in comedic films or comedic television shows, one thing that they always seem to feel the impulse to ask was how much of this was improvised, how much of this was in the script. And generally, they reply, well, no, it was actually all on the page already. It was all kind of already there. We didn't do that much improv. Not to knock improv completely, but there's a lot to be said for a very tightly put together comedy film, which this is. It's so precise. It's tight like a watch, you know, the kind of the setup of the film is that four people check into this hotel with identical bags, four very different people, and Barbara Streisand is this kind of force of nature, kind of destructive, not self-involved, but like, you know, very much like she's been thrown out of so many universities, but she's very intelligent at the same time. And she kind of knows what she wants, and she'll go after it. What she wants specifically is Ryan O'Neill. So she has a bag that looks identical to the bag of this government secrets having man.
What's happening over that side of the table?
A whistleblower from the government has got an identical bag. There's a bag of diamonds that these kind of crooked hotel people want to steal from a wealthy guest. And the final bag is, it belongs to Ryan O'Neill himself. He's a geologist musician, looking for a grant. And he's staying at the hotel for a conference with Madeleine Kahn.
In her film debut. Madeleine Kahn.
She had only done kind of stage stuff before this. This is her very first film, and she's so funny in it.
She's great.
Her character is called Eunice. She comes out, she's got this kind of high pitched voice. She's nagging Ryan O'Neill all the way through, and it's just, it's a star is born, literally. I mean, Streisand is as well very funny, but Madeleine Kahn, you can see instantly the comedic skill that kind of led people like
Mel Brooks
kind of take notice. There's actually quite a few Mel Brooks collaborators in this film, and Kenneth Myers doing a probably an accurate Croatian accent as a professor that's also looking for a grant. But you know, like Barbara Streisand, she spots Ryan O'Neill from across the way, and she decides she has to have him, and she kind of you know, lays a path of destruction behind her, such as her thirst. But it's, you know, when I say that they don't make films like this anymore, that kind of might sound like a kind of a grumpy kind of comment, but like, I think there would be a market for a screwball comedy today. You look at the kind of comedic talent that's out there and the kind of films that they do. We talked the last time I was on the podcast about the
Amy Schumer,
the film, you know.
Yeah, I feel pretty. Yeah.
The films that she could be doing versus the films that she is doing. And if you look at, say, Tiffany Haddish or you know, Kate McKinnon, I think that there are screwball comedies that you could get out of them that would be fantastic. You know, you possibly with them heading towards each other, you know, that kind of thing.
Yeah.
That would be really great. And yeah, just a fantastic film. The audience were in hysterics. And yeah, very, very much worth checking out. The other thing that I saw, which was actually the same day, was Call Me By Your Name, which was showing for the final time at the...
Is it the final, final time?
Probably no, it's not. Not.
They
already
weeks.
Have another one.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's so good. Yeah.
The Roland screen in it.
That I can't go to.
Of course. Yeah,
it was going to be the final time, but I mean, it's got such an audience here in Dublin. People really love it, and understandably so. I mean, what more can you say about it, really? It's a gorgeous film. It's kind of, you feel like you've been on holiday in the north of Italy for several weeks after having come out of it. This was my second time having watched it, and the kind of the dramatic irony that's at play in the film, it really kind of steps up on repeat viewing. You're kind of there with Elio's parents, kind of wryly observing this romance as it blooms between himself and Oliver. What can I say? It's a wonderful film. When it was announced that they were screening for the, I'm doing quotation marks, final time at the Lighthouse, I got a couple of quotes from Charlene Linden, the programmer there, and from Paul Donnelly from the Gaze Film Festival for a film in Dublin about them. They speak about it very well, much better than I can, but if you haven't seen it yet,
it'd be running for the rest of the summer, most likely.
It's and Greatest Showman as a double bill.
It's a wonderful, wonderful film. And it's good in every way that a film can be good. Go check it out. Definitely.
Cool. And Jay, to continue this theme of sunshine and happiness.
Well, actually, that's not totally wrong.
Just mostly.
I was saying earlier, I've been away for a few days, and part of my being away for a few days was very much just relaxing and watching some stuff as well. So I've watched mostly trash.
Which you is, say this as if
no,
you
no, no.
Didn't enjoy...
I've lowered myself down to your rest of your levels.
And you say that...
I am joking, over. No,
as if there isn't a big grin on your
face. Yeah. No, I mean,
is it
know,
a beautiful Jay?
We'll see. No, I saw some good stuff. I saw some absolutely abysmal stuff. But I'll quickly go through them because I don't want to kind of mention most of them if I can. And I'm going to do this in order, have them here. Oh, it's National Treasure, the Nicolas Cage film.
Oh, wow.
Which is really not good. But it has fun. The cast have fun, so you kind of have fun with it. It goes on and on and on. It really does. To set piece after set piece. And I got a bit exhausted by it. But some of the lines were pretty good. And Cage is having a ball.
That's the one that doesn't have Helen Mirren or Bruce Greenwood because that's the sequel, right?
I probably won't be watching the sequel now. But yeah. That's
okay, but there is no Helen Mirren.
No, but it's watchable. Like, it's passable, but it is a little long for that kind of thing, I would say.
It's your mid-tier Indiana Jones knockoff. It's
yeah,
slightly below the Lara Croft Tomb Raider movies.
Yeah, yeah. And it feels that way for chunks of the runtime. But it was okay. Do you want to watch Early Man, the Arden one, which is really not good either, actually,
really?
My surprise. And I'm a huge Arden fan. This felt really minor third-tier Arden. Somewhat sank without trace, I think, a little. And nobody really talked when it came out. It kind of quietly disappeared, I thought. And there's some good moments in it, some good lines, some great set pieces here and there. There's some good sight gags, as you'd expect in an Arden film. But it just didn't sing. And it never caught fire at any particular point. Divert enough, like, if you're rainy afternoon, the kids are... hour and a half or whatever, they might kind of get engrossed a little bit, but it should and could have been a lot better.
I've seen that one.
Did you like it?
It's got good gags in it, but it kind of, the story of it where, you know,
it's escape to victory, isn't it?
Yeah, football
it makes
robots. It's not really enough to kind of
no,
hang
it's
it
not.
It,
it's a lot, it's a very slim
the same
kind
way
of
that
plot.
Chicken Run was like obviously
yeah.
Was
yeah.
The Great Escape.
Yeah, but Chicken Run is
which
much,
is
much better film.
Yeah, definitely. And that's a natural kind of idea.
Yeah. It fits perfectly. Where this feels a little flimsy,
yeah.
To say the least. So, I wasn't impressed at all. We are going to get better here, but I'll start with the absolute clunker of the week. All the Money in the World.
Couldn't convince Jay to watch this movie again.
That's really. Let's discuss.
Not into it.
Here we go, Jay.
Right.
Here we go.
The story.
Jay is rolling.
If you know
the
story, the story is of the J.D. Getty.
J.D.
and his grandson was kidnapped.
Yeah.
In terms of true story. This is one of the mostly based on a true story, true stories.
Yeah.
So, you know, there's obviously characters that are probably.
There's a television show as well with Danny Boyle.
That's right.
That's based around at the same time.
Could only be better. This is extremely heavy handed and extremely long, airless and dull. I just like.
I'll give you two of those.
It never catches. Like, it just drones on and on. And it, like, for a film about like a wealthy person being kidnapped, a plumber. As famously almost essentially CGI'd into the film. I presume they only cast Casey, Spacey, because there's flashbacks to when he's younger.
And well, also because
which
the studio,
they have to digitally de-age plumber, I presume.
Well, they basically, it was part of the condition of the studio giving money for the project. This is basically where Scott, as much as Scott deserves credit for editing out Spacey at the first opportunity and erasing
his
potential legacy and how fantastic that is, there's also a sense of Ridley Scott being Ridley Scott and being, here's a situation, I never wanted Spacey to be my leading man.
Give me
here we go. Yeah, that's exactly. Give me Plummer. Not even 20, however much Mark Wahlberg cost and lunch. But
Why is Mark Wahlberg here?
But I mean, the thing about it is, right, the insertion of Plummer into the film is fantastic, but that speaks to the problem with the film. The film is a film that you can cut around, you can remove most of the characters, the plots never intersect, there's never any sense of it cohering. No. So, like, the fact that Scott could just cut off the
says
thread,
a lot about the problems of the film.
Yeah. Yeah, it says a lot about the film, not necessarily the problems, because I think the result is fascinating. But yeah, it is.
But it's fascinating in a kind of outside the film perspective rather than the film, though.
Yeah.
And the interesting thing I found about it is, like, they get Plummer as a Getty, right? And they kind of announce him pretty early on as, like, the villain, like, of the piece, if you will. Like, he's. But in the sense that he's.
Maybe from your perspective, Jay.
All right, but he refuses. Like, he's the bad guy in the sense he holds me over a barrel. He looks at his ticker tape money thing. But, like,
Jay, if he were to pay a ransom for his son. They all grandson, they'd be
all of them, But what happens is, right, Scott establishes this pretty early on. He's like, okay, he's that guy, right? Let's have four or five more scenes to establish this again in case anybody's missed it.
Yeah.
And then let's have a couple more just to really layer it on. He's you know, it's like, poor Plummer. Like, he does well, but it's so cartoonly.
I actually thought that the Plummer sequences were the bits that worked best. Like, because Michelle Williams is horribly underused. Jesus. Wahlberg is just
boring. They all look uncomfortable.
And underpaid, yes, famously. yeah. But
they all look uncomfortable in the film. Nobody looks cast where they should be, with the exception of Plummer.
Plummer,
they're in the sleep. But, like, Williams looks uncomfortable. Wahlberg looks like you put him in a suit for court for most of the time. And it's such a weird film. And I'm watching it going, who would love this? And I'm sure somebody's going to say, Luke, no, have you seen it?
I have. I was going to say, cartoonish is a pretty good description.
Yeah,
of
he's
this
Mr. Burns. Problem.
Yeah,
that's exactly it.
Darren and I have been talking about it, and I was saying that, you know, throwing out Spacey was kind of the best thing that the film did. Not only is he, you know, terrible and all that, but, you know, that initial trailer that went out that had him in it, you could very much see what he's doing, which is the smarmy, knows how terrible he is thing, which is
they almost look the camera House of Cards a bit.
Yeah, pretty much the same thing.
I watched four episodes that looked every time he looked at the camera he shuddered, and then I eventually stopped watching. This about 4 years ago,
but Plummer, on the other hand, he plays it kind of like Mr. Burns in that one episode of The Simpsons where he works with Lisa to become an environmentalist but actually makes things much worse and is killing all the fish. Like, he genuinely doesn't realise his own.
I don't mind that. Like, I don't mind how he played it, and I don't mind how he set up. I just didn't need to be continuously reminded in every scene Plummer's in, as if the audience has somehow missed it.
It's like, it's a long one.
It lays it on.
I felt like the biggest problem with the film is that it has this kind of, you know, genuinely interesting real life story, but I don't think the film knows which aspect of that is most interesting. It kind of, it's not sure, is the kind of mother who's suffering from her son being kidnapped, is that the avenue? Is it Charlie Plummer playing the actual person that's been kidnapped? I thought he was quite weak in the film.
Me too. We're all of them.
The scenes with him kind of growing this bond with one of the kidnappers.
But that's a very cliche trope anyway in kind of films.
Is Wahlberg the story? No, he's awful in the film.
Yes.
or is it Plummer? Plummer's like, it's a supporting role.
Plummer's fine. He gets out of it. Someone gets out of any kind of dignity.
Mm. I've not seen the Danny Boyle TV show, but it kind of feels like maybe it would work more as a miniseries.
I want to run a mile from the story now, and that's testimony to Ridley Scott's quote unquote talent. I've always said I'm a huge Tony Scott fan, so you know, Tony Scott's great, and I'd watch an All the Money in the World Tony Scott film because he'd be shot through with I don't know how many filters and with zap bang editing all day. But anyway, that'd be about 40 minutes shorter. Right, quickly say other things then before I wrap up. Jumanji, Welcome to the Jungle, which was a great surprise to me how much fun it was.
Oh.
I really, really liked it. Stop shaking your head, Darren. Everything.
I tilted my head as if to say, okay, that's grand.
Yeah, it's great casting. Story is familiar and like kind of standard kind of stuff, but the kind of body swap element they do with it, it works really well because they cast really well for the kind of older...
For the adult.
Yeah, avatars, yeah. I mean, it has to plow through a bit of early exposition lest nobody know how a computer game works. Oh my god, this is simple. Like, what, 3 lives? And if you die, you'll have 2 lives. Oh yeah, turn your arm. Oh yeah. Oh yeah. Can we explain anything else? Is this a cutscene? Like, you know, it still worked quite well even throughout that. But and it, like, it's fun. And they are having fun in it. And I really enjoyed it. It's The Rock doing The Rock. And Jack Black is less annoying than usual. And this is a bonus for me.
It's all winning.
Okay, are we finished? Mama. The horror film from somebody or
other. Someone, Jessica Chastain.
Yes.
Is it Nicola Costello-Wardo?
Yes, that's the one. It's okay. It's some good moments, some interesting ideas. Fatally undermined as so many horror films are by the shock, bang, jump scares, music. Because the music starts about 8 seconds before the jump scare comes. Signal. All right. Eight,
and then it goes a little
seven,
quiet.
Six, five. Oh, there we go. And just undermines absolutely every decent idea it has. Trilogy is pretty good. And the ambition of the ending... The end would be a hell of a lot more impressive if you'd invested in the characters early on, but they don't really do the work there because it's quite ambitious at the end and what they're trying to do, and they almost pull it off. Like it's interesting enough, but it just kind of goes away. But I'll finish the very last one, which is the best one I saw of the week: Bad Neighbors 2, Sorority Rising.
Good, massively underrated.
I'm not kidding. I saw.
And who recommended that, Jay?
Darren did. Let's he not get the credit. I was just about to do that, though, Darren. I saw Bad Neighbours or Neighbours, depending on where you are. The first one, which I thought was quite good, it was okay. I like Roseburn a lot, so I kind of
massively underused.
So I watched the sequel just as if kind of Darren had recommended it. It's like, all right, let's stick it on. But Darren put a word about it, which I thought was interesting and thoughtful, and I think it is. It basically almost interrogates the kind of male gaze of the first film, which is really interesting. It kind of takes on that kind of...
Now I've got to watch 2 movies.
Yeah, I know. Sorry.
A fantastic salesman of terrible movies.
Efron, Byrne and Rogan work really well together on screen.
Efron's never been better in
he's
movies.
He's perfectly cast. He actually brings up a level even in the second film. Like, yeah. I think he's really good. And there's kind of sadness throughout it. There's that whole kind of thing about not moving on and...
And part of you wonders if he's thinking about the fact that he's currently signed on to the Baywatch movie.
But I think if you've seen the first one, it's all the kind of bros, you know, bros.
Fraternity.
But it really gets at why those films exist, even within a sequel to a film that does exactly that.
Yeah.
And like it's good, so like it's so good. And it layers in between so many jokes about dildos and children, which is really impressive.
it's also when I say thoughtful, it's also. It's one of those movies in the same way it leads to Blockers, because this is the movie that led to Kate Cannon being appointed to direct Blockers. Because Rogan and Goldsman brought her in to work on the writer's room for this film, because they wanted... Well, first of all, they wanted a more female perspective after... Because obviously, these comedy films are traditionally frat films, very male-dominated.
Yeah. Yeah.
And so she came up with a number of gags that impressed the writers no end. In particular, there's an extended sequence where... There's an extended sequence where you get a bodily function gag that works on the way that women's bodies are different than men's bodies. And it obviously catches the audience off guard because you're not used to seeing that sort of thing in a mainstream American city comedy. And then afterwards, they pause and have a discussion about how if instead it had been a bag of dicks, it would be fucking hilarious. and it works really well.
It does, and there's a lot of that going on. That's more kind of explicit, and there's a lot of smaller kind of stuff going on that kind of interrogates in the exact same way. And it's very interesting. It's one of the better... kind of studio comedy kind of things I've seen in the last few years, and I thought it was infinitely better than the first one, which is a rare kind of thing anyway.
Add Blockers to your list, Jay.
Blockers on my list. I did also see Game Night as well, which I really enjoyed.
Yeah, Game Night's fantastic.
It is really fun.
Game Night's amazing.
So I had a good trash week.
Yeah. This is what it's like every week for me, Jay.
Darren, I know that's not true, because I know what kind of films you see.
Oh, don't worry. We'll get to some of those.
Oh, yes, no doubt.
Okay, but just to, you know, I rewatched Punch Drunk Love at the weekend. As fantastic as ever. Beautiful, thoughtful, wonderfully tight, very well constructed. It's interesting because it's Anderson, basically, and we had this discussion when we talked about, was it Phantom Thread? Mm-hmm. Anderson is... Interesting enough, you could make a solid case for him as a comedy director who just happens to direct prestige dramas.
Yeah, absolutely.
And one of the things about Punch Drunk Love is it's a screwball romantic comedy, but it's shot like a really intense thriller.
Yeah.
Like that sequence where with the meet cute, where Adam Sandler's character is meeting Emma Watson's character, and basically everything is happening chaotically in the background. The phones are ringing, the forklift is going off, the stuff's falling down. And in any other comedy, this would be like a sequence of like hilarious set pieces and jokes. But instead, with the music playing, the camera is
tied,
the
long take, like,
it's a horror. Yeah, it is, exactly.
It's
a
horror with its like...
Stuff.
It's very stressful to watch.
It is.
It's fantastic.
And Sandler adds much to that.
It's tremendous.
It's really, really fantastic. And probably the closest film, I think, in Anderson's filmography to Phantom Thread. I think it's a very clear... Yeah. Like, I think if you could argue this is a comedy that's shot like a thriller, you could argue to a certain extent that Phantom Thread is a psychological thriller that's constructed like a romantic comedy.
Yeah.
But
I would add one thing for Anderson comedy fans is... The porn film within a film and Boogie Nights with kind of Chester reply at it. It's Wahlberg. Wahlberg and John C. It's imagine that's where John C. already go, oh my god, I could have a comedy career, and successfully went on to do it. But that scene, the kind of quick bash wallop and the kind of investigators is great one as well.
Cool. Also watched American Made, which is a perfectly cromulent film. It's grand.
Just about
it's
okay.
Fine.
I've forgotten 70% of it already.
Cool. I also watched Patriot Day, so we can continue the Marky Mark knockdown.
Of course.
Which is fascinating because it's grand. It's perfectly
what
adequate.
This is
the one about the Boston Marathon bombing.
Oh, I've seen this and I've forgotten about it as well. Actually.
What he does is he constructs it in the style of a 1970s natural disaster film, equivalent to Earthquake or equivalent to Airport. Because this would seem to be how you would approach terrorism today, because you have a wide starry ensemble of people across a diverse range of backgrounds and geographies who are brought together by a coincidence quirk of fate, and who basically lives intersect. So you spend an entire half hour with J.K. Simmons just to get to the point where he does one crucial thing at the climax, that sort of stuff. So you have that, and it's an interesting approach to a film about terrorism, because it effectively depoliticizes terrorism, and perhaps... I don't want to get too down, you know, dissects popular psychology and politics, but maybe speaks to a little bit how Americans see terrorism as something that just happens, in that it's not particularly interested in cause and effect or sort of...
Certainly is not.
Doesn't have any strong history. One of the interesting things about it, though, is the casting of Marky Mark, which apparently was a huge source of controversy to Bostonians. Marky Mark, famous... I'm not going to call him Mark Wahlberg. I'm just going to keep calling him Marky Mark. Marky Mark having famously boasted in that interview that if he had been on one of those planes on 9/11, there would have been blood in first class, which is not the most tasteful thing that a celebrity could possibly have said about.
It would probably have been his blood, though, wouldn't it?
Yes, it would probably have been his
blood. Because I'd be the first one. I'd go for it with first.
Marky Mark... But I don't think that's quite what he was going
for. No,
I
know.
That wasn't quite
so.
The intent
no.
that he had there.
No.
So there's something a little bit distasteful and uncomfortable in the fact that he plays the only fictionalized character in the film. The only character who has no factual counterpart. As if he's writing himself into this story. And in fact, there is something... this is apparently an issue that several Bostonian critics had with the film, was the idea that Wahlberg, who is obviously a famous Boston resident, who had famously said these things about the war on terror, had taken the opportunity to basically position himself as a fictional hero in this very true-to-life, very well-observed story. Because a lot of the details... Like, at the end, there's an extended testimony from many of the real-life counterparts of the characters. It's very touching. Like, it is well enough constructed, but it's very strange watching it and watching Mark Wahlberg.
The interesting thing about that, I think, as well, Aaron, is Peter Berg is the director, I'm sure, isn't he?
Yes.
He's done X amount of films with Mark Wahlberg. That
yeah, so like Lone Survivor, for example.
Yeah, but they're all...
Battleship was Liam Neeson, and somehow didn't feature Liam Neeson saying the line, "They sunk my battleship."
It's just such a wasted opportunity.
But Berg and Wahlberg have gone down this kind of...
patriotic rabbit hole?
Patriotic is a nice way of putting it, but it's certainly...
Jingoistic.
Yeah, jingoistic. It is jingoistic, let's be honest, with Lone Survivor, and even the oil rig one is a little bit like that.
Oh, Deepwater Horizon.
Yeah, so they've this is their bid now, I think. This is like your Scorsese and De Niro for the alt-right.
I don't think Patriots Day is quite that.
No, it's not.
Because and to be fair to it, it makes a conscious effort in depoliticizing terrorism. It manages to avoid a lot of the Islamophobic tropes that you would expect from, say, television shows like 24 around...
That's
like,
a pretty low bar, though.
That is a very low bar.
You know, but I take your point. I think.
Whatever path Berg might be going down, it could always be worse. If we had gotten to Gary Marshall's Patriots.
what an alternative universe that would be, eh?
Wow.
Surprisingly sentimental ending, though, I suspect. You fall in love at the finish line.
and finally, to complete our trilogy of Crime Man and... Geologist Man?
Geologist
Secret
Man. Government Secret Man. I also watched China Salesman. Bringing us a full circle back around to world cinema, which is a Chinese action movie set in Africa, starring Steven Seagal and Mike Tyson throwing down.
You see, this is what Darren watches.
This is world cinema at its finest. Ladies and gentlemen, it is something to behold. There is, for example, to give you a sequence, there's the introductory sequence between Tyson and Seagal, because the film knows what you're here for. Involves a throwdown between them at a bar run by Seagal and attended by Tyson. Tyson, who is playing a tribal African leader who thinks nothing of murdering random strangers, but for some reason refuses to consume alcohol, which angers Seagal to the point where, wait for this, Seagal orders one of his bartenders to serve Tyson a jar of human urine, to which Tyson understandably objects, a fight breaks out, and Tyson utters the immortal line with all the gravity of Arnold Schwarzenegger... Try to make me drink piss, motherfucker, you drink pee. While punching a barrel in slow motion in midair, Steven Seagal, who looks a little bit like late stage Marlon Brando at this point of his career, is saved only through the power of concussive editing. There's lots of quick cuts, lots of whip pans, lots of slow motion.
He can't move those
arms
as quick as he used to be able to.
It's something to behold.
Yeah, like how late stage Brando are we talking about?
We're talking your own.
Oh, it gets better. The only way that they could convince both of the actors to sign on for this was to promise them that their fight would be a draw. You can tell, however, that the moment Seagal left the stage, they brought in his stunt double and had Tyson knock several kind of whatever out of him. It's amazing. Later on in the film, there's a sequence where Seagal, who has shot most of his scenes on his standing bar set, has to leave the bar. His character has to leave the bar to intervene in the primary plot. When he does, he's suddenly, like, 300 pounds lighter, a civet stuntman dressed entirely in leather with a visor on his head where it looks like somebody printed out Steven Seagal's face and put it on the inside. It's amazing. There are no words to describe it. Tyson was famously such a terrible actor that they couldn't film the movie out of sequence, which meant they had to actually move the production across several countries in order to maintain the continuity.
Such a good actor. He needs to stay in character
all the time
to progress.
Yeah. It's astounding, but at the same time, it's a fascinating glimpse of how China sees itself and sees the world. It's a thriller about Chinese telecom companies, which is obviously rooted in the massive scandal a couple of years ago about obviously the back doors that existed in Chinese cell phones and stuff, and their attempts to break into Africa. So it's about a Chinese telecom company that is tendering for a telecommunications contract in Africa. And it is amazing. They are competing against Western powers that seem to be embodied by, like, sentient hair gel that has done nothing but read Ayn Rand. There's a gentleman with slick back hair to the point where even his beard seems to be fashioned into a Luciferian point, who does things like refer to the lead character as China Salesman in a derogatory manner. There's a repeated subplot about how the Chinese don't feel the tendering process is fair, how they're being set up, how they're being framed, how they're being exploited. There's even a really distasteful subplot in which they prevent what is effectively the Rwandan genocide in this unnamed African country on the cusp of civil war. It's staggering. There's a moment in the middle of the film where the north and south of this unnamed but most chaotic country in Africa are engaged in a civil war, and the Chinese have to navigate
the delicate no man's land between them, leading to a sequence where the lead Chinese character ties a Chinese flag to the top of like a flagpole, waves it sort of slow motion in the air while riding on the back of a lorry, to which the militants respond, "Hello, China!" And the China salesman responds, "Hello, brother." It's just, it's amazing.
I kind of want to see this.
Tell me you don't want to see that movie.
I can't tell you that.
This was made from the money left over on the propaganda budget from the Great Wall, wasn't it?
Well, this is very much in the style of Wolf Warrior 2, which is the one last year starring Frank Grillo as Big Daddy, the exploitative American villain who's looking to take advantage of Africa.
Have you seen this?
No, I have not seen this.
Not yet.
But it's astounding because it's basically a look at what a Chuck Norris action movie like Delta Force, what Delta Force must look like to the rest of the world. Because this is how China
sees
itself.
You mean amazing?
Yeah, it's astounding. It's staggering. I honestly think that all telecommunications should be handled through China after watching this movie.
That's what they want you to think, Eric.
It's terrible, but it's terrible and kind of brilliant in its own way. There's so much technobabble about how telecommunications networks work. There's so much insistence that there's no possible backdoor in the code. There's a lot of careful attention paid to the process of tendering, and how careful and precise the Chinese are when it comes to doing this sort of thing, in contrast to the greasy Europeans.
But there's also, not to speak kind of shop, but there's also a kind of issue in Europe in regards to tendering process and Chinese companies actually tendering. I'm aware of this from work. So I'm not going to get boring in it, but this doesn't exist.
This may be your work this may be your work film.
This could be my work thesis.
Tell me it's another thing. There's a moment where
I'm probably going to watch it.
Yeah, there's a moment where the evil Europeans have forced the China salesman, because that's all they refer to the lead character as over the course of the film, to hand over the code to his 3G telecom network, at which point he stares at them and says, "Is this your culture? Slavery, oppression, war. We just want to bring telecommunications to this part of the world." And then he looks at Mike Tyson as if to say, "You know, on some level, you understand." It's something to behold.
And they say every story's already been told.
Yeah, I mean, come on. Telecommunication scandals in Africa in which China prevents genocide. Tell me, like,
5 stars.
That's it right there. No, it's lucky to get 1 star. But so that was my week in film. So I think, did I trash you?
Yeah,
but you
always do.
Aw, thanks, Jay.
It's all right.
All right, so let's move on to talking about the week in film news. The big news this week is the appointment of Gareth Lee as the manager of Screen Training Ireland for the Irish Film Board. Gareth Lee He worked at Barry Ballyfermot College. He's got a long history of education and training in film, particularly around the area of animation. He worked in Ballyfermot College of Further Education, where he ran the animation degree program and established the inaugural diploma program in 3D and visual effects. So the idea is that basically he brings a sort of a wealth of experience.
Oh, I know Ballyfermot College is up the way for me. I'm aware of it. Has a serious reputation.
Yeah, and I mean, to be honest, our sort of animation front is doing very, very well.
Makes a lot of sense that we should lean into that. And
yeah, I mean, how many Oscar nominations and stuff like that? Unfortunately,
for a long time, there was running a short animation nomination pretty much every year.
Yeah,
he's got a very good record on that.
So it's a really good appointment, and it's really interesting. And I think Niall may or may not be getting an interview with him. So stay tuned to Scanon for that. In terms of other news, the Screen Flanders has basically agreed to co-fund Kieran J. Walsh's The Domestique, which is a thriller about the Tour de France, focusing on the domestic, which is a support rider who accompanies a lead rider along there. The film has already received funding from Film Fund Luxembourg, $1.2 million, but it will also be getting a slice of the almost $2 million that Belgian Screen Flanders is investing across 10 different projects.
When you mentioned this, I was like, my long cherished idea of a Stephen Roach boy epic, I thought was coming that bit closer, but alas.
I mean, there's still, I don't know if they've allocated
all of that. Because they could reshoot the Stephen Roach Easy Singles ad from the night there.
That's all your project.
I'd spend like $5 million reshooting that cost about a tenner to make. Which that's can't really dream of such things.
You're allowed to dream.
I certainly am.
And if you are listening, Screen Flanders, please feel free to get in touch. I mean, Jay has some excellent
ideas. I've got something to pitch you.
In terms of otherwise, Lance Daly's Black 47, which was the film that opened the Dublin International Film Festival, now has a release date. It'll be screening, it'll be released in Irish cinemas on the 7th of September.
Very much a word. I missed that 8 hours away.
I have seen it. Definitely go watch it. It's a very interesting and entertaining film. I think you'll come out with it with having a lot to say, I would say.
Well, I do have a lot to say generally. That works a treat for me.
Really, really liked it. It was my favourite Irish film of the festival, which is saying something considering that The Breadwinner also screened at the festival.
Having kind of a tough guy action hero lines being delivered Oscar Elgar is kind of a unique,
satisfying
experience.
It's also wonderfully stylized, and it sort of plays into the general like global trend of the Western being sort of like becoming a horror movie. Obviously, like The Hateful Eight, but the Revenant, which I know is not talked of fondly on this podcast. But to give an example, to give an example of the sort of trend towards treating what the Western as something horrible and colonial, it's basically an Irish addition to that sort of stuff.
Can I ask, you've seen it, how much of it's in Irish? Like, do we know?
I don't know percentage-wise, but
not a huge amount. Okay. No, just wondering in terms of
you kind of
qualification.
You have to go weaving
in
terms of tracking down the main character.
Okay.
Just
as a matter of interest, that being in mind.
The lead character speaks about half his dialogue in Irish, but he doesn't have that much dialogue.
Yeah, given that this is kind of plantation era.
Yeah. Fair enough.
On the outs.
Cool. At the IFI has a strong focus on documentary this summer, so they're doing that summer. They're screening that summer, which is the great artist
today.
Oh, okay. So that one is the prequel, The Grey Gardens.
What it is essentially is a documentary from some people who were going to make a film.
Yeah, the Maisels worked on the camera.
And the film basically fell apart. And it's the bit of
they went back
footage they shot before the Maisels made their version. And it's really, really interesting. Kind of a bit structurally unsteady, but what we're seeing, if you're interested in those, and who wouldn't be?
This podcast and access to a time machine, but well worth seeking out. What is still going on is the Killer Couple season that they're running, which includes Double Indemnity, Compulsion, The Getaway, The Honeymoon Killers, Heavenly Creatures, and Natural Born Killers on 35mm, which was famously banned in Ireland. I think caused some controversy in the IFI itself.
I think there was an injunction to stop it screening, even though it was a private club screening.
Was it something like it was actually stopped as people were in the cinema, if I remember correctly?
It went fairly close to... to point out, this was the 90s and not like 1965 or anything.
So Ireland is...
We had full times back then.
Because I remember, I think you sent around,
there was a book where a chapter had written, and I kind of screenshot a couple of excerpts on it. It was interesting. It was very interesting, actually.
And finally, in the Darren's general interest section of the film news, the unrestored cut of 2001 Space Odyssey will also be screening at certain points over June, which is fantastic.
Yes, and it's two things. One, I want to know what Nolan has to do with this in general terms. Because it seems bizarre. What is his name on it?
Because his name is a brand that's highly recognized. Also because he's the one who basically spearheaded this. While he was working in Warner Brothers on the studio lot, he basically found this reel of film and was basically very taken with how it looked, and so sort of set about working with Warner Brothers to construct a version of the film which is unrestored on it. So it's a print as it would have existed at the time.
What does that mean to the restored version?
You know, the 70mm version that showed, say, 2 years ago. Where's the difference?
I believe the difference is that the idea is that you'll be
the
watching...
The previous one was a restoration?
Yeah,
But are we saying restorations are bad now? I know you're a Nolan fan, and now everybody's thrown at you to the answer for him as a spokesman. But in the context, just having a conversation, the reason I say this, because I've seen a couple of people, and I can't remember now, tweeting about it a couple of weeks ago, particular Blu-rays that have been restored, where particularly in animation it happens quite a bit,
the idea is that to an untrained eye, you don't notice the difference, it looks smoother, but to somebody who's appreciating the actual
thing of it,
detail.
I'm just curious in terms of... Because restoration
it still is, and it's still very important.
I'm just curious about the kind of thing of it.
Well, I mean, being honest, there is something vaguely of the film hipster about this. But it's also the idea of seeing a film that has actually been, like, actually constructed of a real film that has been through the life journey of that. Like, I mean,
it's something that folds into 2001 really well, the idea of, like, the big screen experience, celluloid, the ephemerality of it all, the fact that it's decaying. This is a print that's been in circulation since then. It makes a lot of sense, I think.
I'm not really arguing that, I'm just curious, more than anything.
I mean, and being honest, like, I am just as likely as everybody else to agree with the whole there's no right way to see a film, you know, watching it on a phone. Watching 2001 on a phone is a fantastic experience and it's amazing, but that doesn't discount the fact that seeing it on 35mm or 70mm is a beautiful experience as well of itself.
Seeing battered old prints can be amazing, but then there are other things where a couple months ago I saw Poltergeist and it was pink. Which, you know, was an experience all of its own, but that's, you know,
oh my God.
Nobody's going to tell you that's the right way to see the film, even though it's on a real.
Perhaps
I like the idea of Ronan's right way of seeing Poltergeist being, you haven't seen it until it's probably.
Perhaps my favourite screen was an unbelievably battered version of 35mm print of Mean Streets. And because of this kind of grubby New York aesthetic, it worked beautifully.
Yeah.
And so the lighthouse showed a couple of years back. I think I watched it with Philip. And glorious, absolutely glorious.
It's an incredible experience sometimes because you're looking at it knowing that audiences 40 years ago were looking at this
exact same image.
Yeah. Yeah. Fascinating.
And the fact that every imperfection on it is a mark on the journey. And again, this is where it's very cheesy and it can sound very elitist and artsy fartsy, but where every scratch on it is an example of the journey that it's been through.
Well, being a bit older than you guys, I would have grown up where everything was shot in film, like, and everything you went to see was on film pretty much.
Tell us more about
this. But then you took it for granted. Like, it was just, that's what it was. I mean, that's that. Yeah. And now it's pretty much gone.
That has just brought to mind, I don't know if this will go up before Saturday, but Saturday the AFI at 4 p.m. showing Dawson City Frozen Time.
Which is
terrific.
Yes.
We saw it.
It's a film very much about what we're talking about.
Yeah, at the Double Film Fest. Yeah. And it's just tremendous.
It is a very beautiful film, and it's very much, it's about film, and it's also about history captured through film. Not necessarily on film so much as around film.
And the awkward intersections of cinema and capitalism.
Not really awkward. It's not really an intersection so much as like a parallel journey. I like the idea of cinema, pure cinema, existing beyond the reach of capitalism.
Also, the IFI are also showing Aliens.
Yes, they are.
I think seeing a film like that kind of on film would be very interesting because it's, you know, if you look at the time period, you're starting to get away from, you're starting to get into more digital effects.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And Cameron certainly got more into digital effects. So kind of seeing one of his.
I've seen Alien on 70mm and UFI a few years back.
Jay, we will spot you a ticket for Alien.
I won't be going to see Aliens.
I am, because I think I've only seen it twice, maybe, and I'm not crazy about it, but I'll give it another.
I'm not
give
crazy
a third
at
go.
All.
But
enjoy.
I'm not a big fan.
Once they get Alien 3 on 70.
Finally.
That's the moment.
That's what we're all there
that's
for.
What we've been
that's what we're finding
can,
it all
can
unite.
Can you do the literal assembly cut with that screen?
Yeah, yeah.
But anyways, let's move on to talking about the top 10. At number 10, it's On Chisel Beach. Hasn't pulled out yet.
Oh my. I am
Jesus.
Hoping
to... And I just realised, by the way, that I accidentally misidentified Emily Watson as Emma Watson.
Oh no.
I know. I'm retroactively embarrassed for me from earlier in the podcast.
I'm hoping to catch it this weekend, as per my previous appearance. Really excited for it, but just haven't got the time yet.
Ah. At number 9, 2001 A Space Odyssey.
Nice.
Well, that's in the lighthouse, isn't it?
Yeah,
it's doing quite well. They're keeping it around.
There's a reason we're keeping it back, I guess. People like seeing it. So.
Yeah.
A gross of 13,000, which is remarkable when you consider the amount of new entries that we had last week and the amount of carryover and the fact that it's summer as
it's
well.
Pretty goddamn good.
It's pretty great.
Should have won it. It's probably like
this,
a bomb.
Who is this Kubrick fellow?
Yeah.
I mean, he's the future.
This guy's got a bit of
class. Yeah. At number 8, hanging on in there, Life of the Party, a studio comedy that I haven't seen yet, which
is
the most
shocking
one. I know.
Get on that there.
I mean, maybe it's just not trashy enough.
Mm.
Maybe that's the issue.
Your previous story about the Chinese animation film would suggest that you'd be okay here.
That I'll manage somehow. At number 7, another comedy in here is I Feel Pretty, which you were talking about earlier, which is the Amy Schumer film, which is still there, still doing great business.
Yeah,
it's
doing really well.
Well on its way to €1 million here, which is quite impressive. Nearly 800,000 so far.
Studio comedies do well here.
They do. Well, that's, again...
kind of, Schumer is a good draw as well.
That's why I think they send over as many people to open.
In good weather, if your arm is going to be twisted to go into the cinema, it's generally for something kind of light.
Yeah, probably correct, yeah.
And particularly because they tend to be shorter. Even now with the bloat happening, comedies are still shorter. You're still talking 100 minutes.
150 minutes.
That's it, exactly.
It does put into perspective how well 2001 has done that, doesn't it?
Yeah.
Like in terms of
just
the opposite of what Lucas
Ames.
Yeah.
And then... also showing, also at number 6, Sherlock Gnomes, still in there.
Lord.
Somehow
have you no gnomes to go to?
Because, of course, the children have finished school again now, so they have to go see some films.
Ronan, that sounds like you're the old grandpa Lodge trying to complain about the time kids have left school in the summer.
Standing on our footpaths,
crowding our streets, enjoying their popular music.
Their iced creams.
At number 5, Avengers Infinity War is still there, having earned 4.6 million at the Irish box office.
Still haven't seen it.
Astounding success story, as one might imagine, being the culmination of the Marvel Cinematic Universe. And yet, still performing really,
so
really well.
It looks like superhero movies are just going to keep breaking it in. So when do we get Matter Eater Lad, is what I want to know. When
nice,
do we get
deep
that film?
Legion of Superheroes, right there. Eventually. Law of Averages. It feels like it'll be a Nicolas Cage movie.
Oh, please!
Like,
that would be a masterpiece.
Nicolas Cage as Matter Eater.
Mom and Dad for him, just eating fences.
But eating scenery, primarily.
Perfect casting.
But it is, yeah. It's, this is the whole Spielberg Brooks Scorsese. Is the superhero movie going to have sort of a drought like the Western did? Or is it just going to keep on raking money?
Yeah, but the Westerns were like a couple of hundred a year. I won't wait.
That's exactly.
I mean, this isn't a direct evolution, but the superhero movies are the Westerns. The Westerns moved into the city via Clint Eastwood in, say, Coogan's Bluff and Dirty Harry. And action movies, which evolved out of those kind of cop thrillers in the 70s, have now migrated to superheroes. It's not a direct causal effect.
You can go even further and argue that, like, samurai to cowboy, to cowboy to urban vigilante to dude in tights. It's a very sort of clear linear progression. I mean, you can throw in like the astronaut and space pulp hero in the middle there as well if you want to treat the superhero as a fusion of those. I mean, in terms of like a cultural history of America, I think the superhero is the current pulp form.
While we've been speaking, DC have probably announced Matter Eater Lad.
Sorry, Jared Leto.
They'll never get made.
But
Ridley Scott.
We need Jared Depper.
Matter Eater Lad starring...
from visionary director.
I mean, but you say that, they announced today, was it the Jared Leto Joker movie, which is distinct from the Joaquin Phoenix Martin Scorsese Joker movie.
It's not a Scorsese.
No, it's produced
please don't
by
do that
starring
to me.
Todd Phillips.
Paid Scorsese $2 million to put his name on the poster.
Joaquin Phoenix as the Joker in a film produced by Martin Scorsese, directed by Todd Phillips, director of Hangover. Come on, tell me.
Can we just say, though, Scorsese as a producer has put his name on any old shite.
Was it
that,
Easy
like,
Money?
Has,
was
he
one
had,
of the
like,
great
I mean,
examples?
Department gave $2 million to give the whole thing a veneer of respectability, I would imagine.
I like to imagine that they said, we have some easy money for you, and he's like, where do I sign?
For what? Where would you make that?
But yeah, it's, so... Again, whether or not any of those will actually see the light of day.
Stop making Joker films.
Quentin Tarantino's Ambush Bug. 2021. Calling it now.
Ava DuVernay's new film
is
actually interesting.
His Branson film.
Which one?
Tarantino. Is he still doing that?
Manson, you mean?
Branson film would be something great.
You want to see that?
Once Upon a Time in Hollywood. He's also doing the 5th Star Trek movie, which is amazing because it parallels. It parallels neatly with, like, because all the new Star Trek movies line up with the original film in some way, shape, or form. So, like, for example, the second one has Khan, the third one has the Enterprise blowing up, and most of the crew stranded on a planet. So, I'm hoping the 5th one will line up with the 5th one in which William Shatner directs himself against the only opponent that William Shatner deems good enough to fight Kirk. God.
Mm-hmm. Sounds like Tarantino.
So tell me that doesn't sound like a Tarantino movie waiting to happen.
DiCaprio fights himself.
They announced actually a lot of new cast members for the Madsen Tarantino film. Damian Lewis is playing Steve McQueen.
Is Polanski still going to be in this?
Sharon Tate's going to be in it. Polanski was in Europe at the time, so hopefully they can leave him out there.
Tarantino's going to try to squeeze him in
on a phone. From a shoddy London set.
At number four, Show Dogs.
Okay.
All right. Fine. Moving on. At number three, Book Club.
I actually really want to see this. I love all of these actresses.
Yeah.
And
it's great.
They look like they're having a great
stuff.
Time. And when they're having a great time, I usually do.
I really want it to rain so I can go see this.
Yeah, it's that kind of thing.
Yeah. Also, there's really, I can't remember who did a tweet.
Was it Casper Salmon about
the food? Yes, about the food and the poster for it. Greatly amused me, I have to say.
Yeah.
Speaking of things that will greatly amuse Jay, at number two, Deadpool 2.
Yeah.
I liked it.
I liked it a great deal as well. It's a very simple 80s action movie that disguises itself as a postmodern self-aware comedy.
I liked it a lot more than I thought I was going to. It is wearisome in some points. Not all the jokes land, but I thought it was... I there's so many superhero films now, they can stand to be taken down a peg, and I thought it did it pretty well.
Yeah. I mean, I think... It's like the first one, it's not as subversive as it thinks it is, or as its proponents think it is, but it works well because it's basically the sort of earnest, low-key action movie that you used to get in the 80s, but you can't get anymore for various reasons, because people expect world-building, because people expect the shared cinematic universe, because the stakes always have to be the end of the world or the universe itself. So like Deadpool 2 is a superhero movie that's effectively about family and whether or not you can save a little boy's soul. And the way in which it gets away with that sort of low-key, 80s action movie beat is by just being wry and cynical and smug and ironic about it, because it's easier to accept that level of earnestness or sincerity when it's couched in irony or self-awareness. It's a movie that does, it plays, for example, Pat Benatar's We Belong in, a knowing wink and nod, but also kind of seriously, which is a very delicate balance.
I think Deadpool benefits from having, foils. I think Josh Brolin and I can't remember her name, but
Domino is as he beats.
Yeah, from Atlanta.
From Atlanta, yes.
They're both very good in the film. Well, yeah. Brolin is good, she's very good. I think it kind of softens the
unrelented Ryan Reynolds.
Having someone within a film rolling their eyes at a character that can be eye roll worthy, kind of. Helpful.
It makes it exciting. Yeah, and adds a sort of a layer of irony to the irony almost.
Yeah.
And at number one, Solo, A Star Wars Story.
Mm.
Which is doing well, but not nearly well enough. The first flop of Disney's sort of, arguably, since their big massive expansion where they started buying your childhood, really. Because I don't think any of the Marvel Cinematic Universe movies have really bombed aside from Incredible Hulk, and that was before Disney basically purchased them.
Yeah.
So this is an interesting case study.
Is
in which
it
support.
The case that it's actually going to be a bomb, or is it just
no.
performing? Yeah.
It learned less than its budget and marketing value.
No.
But that's because they have to reshoot 70% of it. For some reason, as we pointed out,
cost a lot.
That does tend to cost a lot when you have to shoot a movie twice. But it basically costs more than The Force Awakens, which is an absurd situation for a solo movie about Solo. I liked it. It's grand. It's perfectly fine. Watching it, you would have no idea that it had been through the horrific trauma that it had been through. You would have no idea that anybody ever cared particularly strongly about it at all.
I definitely feel that.
And it's Ron Hartford. Sorry, I never miss a chance. You set that up there.
I know. But it is. It's competent. It's well made. It's clean. It's efficient. I actually quite like, I think the final third is a point where it almost takes off. It finally stops doing, it's a series of extended, Western homages. It's the Great Train Robbery. It's Wages of Fear. And then suddenly, in the third act, it becomes this almost, Magnificent Seven sort of thing. But it allows the characters to start bouncing off one another. The only issue is that at that point, it becomes incredibly fanservice-y to a point of distraction. But, I liked it. It was much better than I suspected it was going to be.
Train robbery scenes should be as boring as the one in Solo is.
Yeah, the camera is always perfectly level. It's this is a perfectly serviceable train robbery.
Ron Howard takes Han Solo to the greyest planet in the universe.
Tell my wife I said hello.
Donald Glover's greatness. I mean, I like the lead actor. I think that he does well to do Jack Nicholson instead of Harrison Ford, if only because doing a Harrison Ford impersonation would seem invite comparisons that you playing the role in the first place have already invited. But yeah, it's not.
I'll hope to get to it at some point. I probably should go through that before Infinity War, so I'll probably be able to there a lot longer.
you've got to keep in mind that this is with the World Cup coming up, the summer season here is quite empty. In fact, there's a bit of a disturbance that we'll probably talk about when we get to the new release and stuff like that. But there's a huge dearth of big blockbustery films between this week and the release of The Incredibles in July.
With the
World Cup.
Well, this is good, but then I can
watch
both. I can watch movies and the World Cup.
Yeah,
is there that big a thing?
Five weeks and 64 matches.
God, to be kidding.
Yep.
64 matches.
Okay, so, let's jump into talking about.
Thank heavens it's only every 4 years. By the time 4 years is over,
the European Championships every 2 years.
I forget how much it overtakes.
It takes everything. And America just looks on confused. Okay, let's do this.
That's because you didn't qualify.
Yeah, they're not in this one. Yeah.
Let's jump into this then. So the new releases this week include Jurassic World Fallen Kingdom, which is releasing a full 2 weeks ahead of the US in order to get in just under the line ahead of the World Cup, which is unprecedented in terms of Universal's big releases.
Mm. Although the World Cup starts next week, though.
It does, yeah. So it's
is it already released?
It was released on Wednesday.
I see this. It used to be just Fridays. I get confused then. This is going to be me when I'm 60 trying to figure out a way to release films.
We talked about this.
Sundays?
So the Quantum of Solace is 8-day opening weekend?
Oh, stop. It's such a bad film that there's so much wrong with it that you have to
bring
it out.
Not Quantum of Solace, sorry. It was Spectre. Spectre's 8-day.
Well, it still applies.
It should be possible.
Holiday Monday. So you stretch from Saturday through to the following Monday, and that's it. It's amazing. But basically, so for example, because Fallen World moved forward in our calendar, that means that Ocean's 8 has moved back 2 weeks. So it's releasing in the States this weekend. It won't be out here until the middle of the World Cup, where it's seen as counter-programming.
Yes.
Ocean's 18. It's moved to the 18th. That's my mistake, I apologize. There's also, for example, Ant-Man and Wasp has moved back by a whopping, was it month and a half to the middle of August here? Because all the films that the US is getting in the World Cup period are coming out immediately in July. The Incredibles is opening in the middle of July in the States, middle of June in the States. It's opening almost as soon as the World Cup is finished here.
There's going to be a problem with spoilers, isn't it?
Such a big effect. That's amazing.
It's an amazing disturbance to watch. Because I remember I was looking at the list of films that are coming out, wondering, why is there nothing happening for 5 weeks in cinemas? And it's somebody had to actually explain to me that there was this thing outside of cinemas. I was like,
there's two things that are right. One, I love the World Cup, so I'll be watching it, right? Pretty much every match. So we'll get that out of the way. So we can start off with a proper conversation.
Okay.
Second thing, this might actually give me a chance to catch up on the shed loads of films that I've missed from the first 6 months.
Yeah, well, I can't wait. I'm not be watching a single film.
No, well, you're better off.
I'm going to spend all the time in the MT cinema watching Book Club over and over again. I can't wait.
He will.
Ronan is your counter-programming target audience here. It's
I will be alone on the podcast.
Talking to myself. About Book Club for an hour.
On the fifth.
Shooting to number one.
It's number 10 and number 1.
Recalling your name back again, suspiciously.
Yeah.
On my fifth rewatch of Book Club, this is what I noticed. The aperitifs were fantastic. But anyway, so let's talk a little bit about Jurassic World Fallen Kingdom. Luke, have you seen this?
I have seen it. And after I saw it, I went onto Twitter and I said that the kind of difficulty in evaluating it was figuring out if it was just completely awful shite, say the Jaws sequels, or if it was mad wonderful shite,
the Jaws sequels.
I think it might be better than Jurassic World, which I didn't care for at all.
That's because it's appalling.
It's a terrible film.
Yeah, but it's not very good at all. It kind of I go through kind of plot and all that.
Let's go. I have seen this as well.
So
I take it Jay and Roman aren't particularly
suspect a film like this is unspoiled.
I didn't say Jurassic World.
You would think, but
have at it, Luke.
The T-Rex demands your silence.
That went viral as well.
There are spoilers to be had in Fallen Kingdom, but the premise is that there's an imminent volcano eruption on the island where the dinosaurs are living, either Nubar or whatever
it's
called.
I think it's Numa, yeah.
The risk management assessment of the people at Jurassic Park, stellar as always. But
Dad, we should stop breeding dinosaurs. This is not going well.
Stop breeding dinosaurs on an island with an active volcano. It's like, how many risk factors do you need? You realize they don't cancel each other out, Fred. It's like,
so James Cromwell plays up to this point
fresh out of prison,
unmentioned,
suspiciously similar to Richard Hammond, to the point where my mother, who was attending the screening, asked, is that the man from the first Jurassic Park?
He does have a painting on the wall.
He has a painting.
Cromwell's mansion. That's James Cromwell.
he also
very
has
a different film.
He also has a scepter with the amber in it as
that's
well.
Right.
And he's a beardy, white-haired guy. So if you were a casual Jurassic Park fan, you would be, forgiven for confusing him with a recast Richard Attenborough.
So kind of in the same sense that when you watch an episode of Murder, She Wrote, and she has some long lost cousin that she's never mentioned before. Cromwell plays a up to this point never before mentioned scientific partner of John Hammond, who collaborated with him on the DNA cloning of the dinosaurs up until the point where they had a massive falling out over something that will definitely not become relevant later in the film. because the dinosaurs are about to become extinct again from the eruption of the volcano, there's this kind of big debate about whether or not they should be saved. There's kind of a
Jeff Goldblum cameo
is summoned
to one day of filming in
Park
that
truck full of money at his house, please do it.
To debate whether they should be allowed to survive. He says no, and Cromwell enlists Bryce Dallas Howard, excuse me.
Jay's favourite Howard, by default.
Absolutely. And Chris Pratt to go to the island to rescue the dinosaurs. In particular, Blue, everyone's favourite raptor, I suppose.
He's not doing air quotes, but you can hear it.
Yeah. Cromwell is the money behind this project, but he's kind of old and infirm, so kind of it's all being spearheaded by Rice Ball.
I wonder if he's going to be a bad guy at some point.
He's doing a dreadful American accent, and his introduction, he is so friendly as to be obviously considered to be evil.
Also, he's Race Ball. It's kind of his bit.
They go to the island. It turns out that they were set up.
What? Oh, what are the odds?
You are kidding me.
You can't. If you can't trust billionaires who breed dinosaurs, who can you trust?
So it's kind of this disaster movie on an island for half of the film, and then it goes completely off the rails. The kind of unscrupulous military vague bad guys cart the dinosaurs off on boats to the secret underground lair laboratory
that
Rafe Spall is keeping in Cromwell's home. Unbeknownst entirely to Cromwell himself.
They sneak dinosaurs in there.
They need dinosaurs in order to sell them off as weapons to various Captain Planet-esque evil villains from
the
world.
Do you just sell dinosaurs to evil dudes on Earth, as opposed to space?
What's his name?
What? Toby, what's his name?
Tell me it's not Toby Jones.
Toby Jones.
It keeps him making, he can do the detractors for the rest of
it's
his life.
It's just kind of
like the murderer into the studio to this.
Dinosaur auctioneer to the stars, working with Spall. To sell off. It's off the rails.
We haven't scratched the surface yet. Everything that Luke has said to this point is entirely accurate.
Yeah.
But it's amazing. It's not a good film, but it's a wonderful bad film. It's a fantastically clever, stupid movie. It's astoundingly... It's at some point in some pitch meeting, somebody at Universal Pictures stood up there, put up their hand boldly, and said, "What if?" And they said, "What if? What if Nosferatu, but with dinosaurs?" And somebody in Universal Pictures said, "Sold."
It's astounding. There's a point, like, it doesn't, it swaps from a natural disaster movie in its first half to a gothic horror vampire movie with dinosaurs in its second half. There are several sequences where, for example, a little girl has her back to the shadows and a little claw reaches out, like Nosferatu's fang, waiting to brush her hair gently and creepily. It's a staggeringly weird movie.
Guys, there's a sketch. I don't know if any of you have seen Amazon Women on the Moon, which is one of those...
I saw them in Jurassic World Fallen Kingdom. Spoiler.
It's a kind of a sketch movie made in the kind of 70s, 80s kind of... you know, the like kind of Kentucky Fried movie. And that kind
of, it's a sketch show.
But one of them sketches where Jack the Ripper's a dinosaur. And this one sounds like, all right, you're looking for a good time, Governor. And there's a big dinosaur with a you know, a flat cap on it. This reminds me of this, exactly what this is. I've got to get that to Twitter soon before somebody steals it.
It's very much like a weird hybrid of Kong Skull Island meets, like, Rise of the Planet of the Apes. It's the most bleak and cynical Jurassic Park sequel since The Lost World, which works rather well because Bayona pitches this as a horror movie, which is a smart and canny choice because Jurassic World, which is one of the worst films I have ever seen, and I watched China Salesman this week, it goes for wonder. It tries to emulate Spielberg and can't manage that because nobody on this planet can do wonder better than Spielberg. So what Bayona does is he says, okay, let's look at, like, Lost World, which is the misbegotten sequel of Jurassic Park, and let's do horror. Let's say that these creatures, these wonderful, awe-inspiring dinosaurs that were meant so much to so many children, that where the John Williams score basically resonates in the hearts of an entire generation. What if we take that and we turn it into a horror movie? And this is something that the film, I think, is doing quite intentionally and quite cannily. There's a moment later in the film where Bryce Dallas Howard, who is currently locked in a dinosaur paddock for reasons that will become clear when you watch the film, asks Chris Pratt, do you remember when you first saw a dinosaur? What that awe and wonder felt like? And it feels almost like the film is reflecting on the state of the Jurassic Park franchise, where something that was beautiful, that was wondrous, that was incredible, has become something crass and soulless and cynical, where awe has metastasized into horror, where wonder has become terror. And there's a sense that, like, Bayona's playing with that within the structure and context of the film in a way that feels self-aware and playful. There's a moment where Toby Jones, as dinosaur auctioneer to the stars, promises the room assembled of, like, the extras who didn't get killed by Liam Neeson in Taken, and says, I promise you, the creature of tomorrow, manufactured from pieces of yesterday. And it's like, this is exactly what the film is selling. And then the film proceeds to brutally murder all of the people who are guilty in this capitalist exploitation of wonder. And it's...
Can I say something? Can I ask you a question? Would your enjoyment and or enthusiasm for this film be centred, and my suspicion is that it would for me, on the intentional or otherwise, how would you believe that this is not just off the rails terrible, as opposed to intentionally doing what you were saying?
I think it's reasonably well made in that Bayona knows what he's doing with it. It's pulpy and it's trashy. Again, this is one of those, like, an image out of context from the film, which makes barely any more sense in the context of the film. There's a moment where a velociraptor is silhouetted against the moon, howling like a werewolf.
When the Latin chanting came in, that's when I really lost it. I'm not kidding.
No, we're not kidding. It's, again, and it feels like Bayona has basically, like, he's done the smart thing. He's looked at basically the other Jurassic Park sequels and said, trying to emulate Spielberg at this stage is like a loser's game. What you need to do...
take it up and
it's just
seven
go
notches.
Off the rails. And it does, and, like, I think it's reasonably, like, the plot makes no sense. There's an incredibly cynical, like, as you pointed out, like, basically Cromwell is playing Richard Attenborough, but cheaper, and also alive.
Yeah.
But there's even, like, Ted Levine's character, who's playing...
God.
He's at one point introduced as a great white hunter, as if to say, well, Pete Bothwaite is dead, so here's who we have. The film is very consciously aware of what it's doing. And, like, there's a sense at which, like, if you are game for what it's doing, I think it's an enjoyable, fun ride.
in the same way that, like, Rampage, my favorite movie of the year, to quote Roman, is an enjoyable, fun ride if you're willing to go along with it. I think if you are skeptical about it, you're...
You are an incredibly generous person there, and that's all I'll say.
Thank you, Jack.
Your enthusiasm for what commonly most people would refer to as garbage is staggering.
Hearing all this makes a lot of sense. When I saw the poster, I was like, what are they trying to sell? That pretty much. The poster kind of gets that idea across. I saw a poster, I was like, how much is going on in this movie?
I could never have imagined a Jurassic Park sequel that would look like this. And that's kind of exciting, given how terrible Jurassic World was.
The difficulty I think I'm having in categorizing whether it's awfully good or awfully shite is that this is it's very well directed by Bayona. You know, there's kind of a pre-title sequence.
Yes, which is very well done.
Which is very well done.
It's arguably better than anything in Jurassic World.
Definitely.
And it establishes
That kind of more horror tone that comes back later in the film after the disaster elements. And I mean, Bayona has done disaster films and horror films, so he's a very good choice.
And somehow it's more tasteful when he does it with extinct dinosaurs than it was when he did it with entire populations. Yes.
And I thought the film became much more enjoyable once it got to that kind of Resident Evil mansion setting and kind of went completely mad. You could be there all day, but there is a scene where a raptor smells gas that's like it's going to blow. And like an action hero, it jumps.
That's way.
That gas then furls through the secret underground laboratory that's been kept from James Cromwell against his knowledge, like mist rolling over the moors. There's a moment, at one point, where my mom turned to me and said, "That velociraptor, why is it opening that child's bedroom door from the outside?" And I'm like, because they're doing a Dracula homage. And I'm kind of with it.
Bayona directs the film very well, but he is directing a script written by Colin Trevorrow, which I've learned how it's pronounced.
But I'm not a huge Bayona fan or Trevorrow fan, so I'm going to be in trouble with
Trevorrow is a...
a hack.
Not a great writer. I would say the characters are awful in the film. I'm not a person that's like, oh, there's a plot hole or this bit doesn't make sense, you've lost me. Never like that.
Given what we've watched, I feel like if you were that person, your head would have exploded.
This is logic takes a holiday. Nothing in the film makes any sense. And again, I don't mind kind of nitpicky stuff like that if the film
should make sense, right? Unless.
If the film has an emotion, if the film has an idea in its head, I kind of will forgive it certain logical leaps. But the problem with this film is that Trevorrow is a person that thinks that he has an idea and he hasn't got a clue whatsoever. The film is itself confused about whether these dinosaurs are animals that need to be looked after and preserved and isn't so beautiful and wonderful, or if they're horrific beasts that need to be
exterminated. I think it's more than
exterminated.
It just hates people.
It's remarkably cynical. It's so, so stupid. I was kind of reading up about, because Trevorrow is coming back to direct the third one that they're definitely going to make because these films make so much money.
Yeah.
And he was talking about how much I won't say what happens at the end of the film, how much he wanted to get to that point and kind of lead off there. And that kind of tripping over himself to get to where he wants to be so he can play with these toys again and forget whoever has to do Fallen Kingdom is kind of quite palpable. And
it is, but it kind of makes Fallen... I liked it more than I liked any non-Spielberg Jurassic Park film, which is the lowest bar that a film can pass. Really, you like 3?
No, the thing that gets me about these films is that, as compared to the other mega blockbusters that everyone comes out to see,
another
one,
and
blah, 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 blah. People normally like the first one.
Yeah, that's
people only like the first one, generally. And yet, when they brought this one back, they came out in their droves, and I was like, do you not remember Jurassic World 2? Do you not remember Jurassic World 3? And now with this one, which will presumably make a lot of money, do you not remember Jurassic World, which was awful?
We had this discussion with people who are not film people, and their response was, nobody ever asked you what your favorite dinosaur was?
In as much as the kind of added horror element is good for this film and kind of is better than it's been in other films, this, you know, people like dinosaurs, but this is essentially dinosaurs run amok and kill people. And
yeah, but aren't all
you see that in Jurassic Park? Yeah. So what it, you know, and the thing that has Colin Trevorrow so excited is even more so they're going to be dinosaurs. Getting people, and it's like, that's your big idea.
Yeah.
He said it took three films to get to the point that he wanted to get it to.
Yeah.
He wanted to do it justice. And the big idea that he's building up to is, what if even more dinosaurs?
What if Jurassic Park, but more?
That's
yeah.
a big idea,
which,
right?
Which is Jurassic World. Like, Jurassic World is what if Jurassic Park, but more. Jurassic World 3 is presumably going to be Jurassic World, but more.
Aren't
yeah. Jurassic Park
aren't they all the same idea, though?
They're all the same idea, yeah. Which is why Nosferatu, but with dinosaurs, is such a fascinating concept.
I'm in.
You're
really?
Old.
Just
no,
not
no, 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 no.
I
no,
feel
no.
you're
overselling
it.
Hard pass, hard.
Yeah. Oh,
I'm not a Bayonis
very
fan.
Convincing, but I was a hard pass.
I don't like Bayonis films. I don't like Trevorrow's writing or films. So, yeah. This and Jurassic World was an abomination. So,
Jurassic World was
I'm not going to get filled again. By you or anyone, Darren.
I didn't feel a tang of guilt.
Although Luke sounds more honest about it. You sound like you're selling me a...
Yeah, I do feel nervous. People who have like listened to me talk about it, and I'm quite candid, it's not a good movie. I think it's an enjoyable, pulpy, fun movie. But people have been like, I wasn't going to see this, but what you talking about it has made me want to see it. And I'm like, I'm not sure that's
yeah,
a
that's
good
not
they're all going to come home for you, Darren.
A few points in, I might have enjoyed it more. I didn't have the necessary equipment in the cinema to get through it. I mean, you know, even the kind of off the rails, madcappy, horror-influencey stuff. Like, you know, if Cromwell is living in a sinister monster mansion with a secret basement where evil experiments are being done, I don't know if you've seen American Horror Story, the season that he was in. I mean, Cromwell possibly should have been evil in that,
yeah.
And instead he's Hammond Light. You know, you got Geraldine Chapman kind of running around the mansion as this, like, matron.
Yes.
To the...
adorable
kid du jour. And you know she kind of isn't really used. So
actually,
you could have camped those kind of elements up
because you're
when
going
they did do that,
that
was when
over.
I was kind of starting to get on board. It kind of the disastery stuff if they kind of had less of that because that's just
yeah that's
so
conventional stuff.
It's
yeah.
crap. It's not,
yeah.
it's not much use. But
I mean, in terms of that second half, actually, like I quite liked the mean spiritedness. Like it's very much. It's one of those like anti-human blockbusters like The Girl with All the Gifts or the Planet of the Apes movies or Ex Machina where it seems to be like, hey, extinction may not be the worst thing for people.
Those films are much smarter than
this. They are much, much smarter than this. Like, this is an example of how it's sort of dribbled down. It's like when your revisionist westerns are now like starring Bill Pullman, that's when you know that it's sort of it's permeated.
I mean,
this is like when your anti-human films are a Jurassic World sequel, you know that you've sort of this thing has become...
It's not cool anymore.
Yeah. But I mean, I actually quite like the fact that, like, for example, the scenes in which they play the adorable characters interacting with dinosaurs, except instead of running from dinosaurs, they're running from Raphael Stahl, who is basically a lizard man. Like, I quite like that sort of, like, little playful stuff.
And, you know, like, Bion has clearly told, like, BD Wong and Ted Levine to kind of...
Yeah, camp
it up big time.
Yeah, no.
Levine was really getting on my nerves. I mean, you know, Cromwell is playing Attenborough because Attenborough is no longer with us. Like Levine is playing Ernest because Ernest went to the
dinosaur
yeah,
shop.
Yeah.
The other big release this week, or the other release this week, is The Boy Downstairs, which I had not even heard of before.
That's a big release, isn't it?
It is. Written and directed by Sophie Brooks. It's the story of a young woman who's forced to reflect on her first relationship when she inadvertently moves into her ex-boyfriend's apartment building. Starring Deirdre O'Connor, Sarah Ramos, Zazo Mamet, and Matthew Shear.
This has in American Indie written all over.
It really does, and particularly the poster. Obviously, listeners can't
see
the poster.
Oh, that has a Sundance
film
about it.
It has the look of a Sundance film about it.
Oh my. I bet you there's a quirky scene that's there for no other reason just to make the film stand out as quirky in the middle of it somewhere. I can almost guarantee it.
All right. Well, Jay, that's your task for the week in question.
Yes.
If you
not
go back
Jurassic
and
World
on
Fallen
that,
Kingdom.
I feel like I have a better time getting to go see the Sundance film, to be honest.
I think you're probably
that's
correct.
The pitch there. But anyway, if people want to find a bit more Jay, a bit more Luke, a bit more Ronan in their lives, where can they find you?
At Jay Quine on Twitter.
I'm at Mr. Cynical on Twitter. I should say that's C-I-N-E-Z-A-L, like cinema. It seemed funny 10 years ago.
It's very hard when you have to articulate puns as Twitter handles.
Yeah, yeah. And I'm also on filmindublin.ie.
I am on Twitter at Baron Ronan, and I have a new column in the latest issue of Cinerin, so do please check that out.
Oh, me too. Ronan's article is very good.
I haven't. I'm waiting for the print edition to read the full thing.
It's Queer Era, is it?
The Queer Era, yeah.
Queer Era. Ah. I thought it was... How do you pronounce it?
So, Queer Era as in Ireland, but also Ire Anger.
Ah, see what you did there.
Because yeah. I'm across.
Puns
story.
Don't really work on audio.
No.
But anyway, you can follow me at Darren Roberts-Grimini. You can follow Scanlon at scanlon.com. As the gentleman have just pointed out, the new issue of Cinerin is available online from Jumba. You can also order or subscribe for a print edition that will get shipped directly to your home.
Which you should do, because it's delicious to hold in your hand.
It really is. And it's a very, being honest, it's an enterprise worthy of supporting, I can say, mm-hmm. as somebody who's not involved in it financially. So, ladies and gentlemen, take it easy. We'll be back next week. Until then, bye.
Bye.
Thank you.